we're going to get to a point in this conversation where we can say the word ethical and media without anybody guffawing. We are going to get there. So we're going to ask questions like, what does an ethical media look like? Why do we need it? And how can we get there from here? Now, of course, there's a few housekeeping things I have to look after. So if you've got a mobile phone and you haven't switched it off, can you please do that? And, of course, everybody knows you can't smoke in here. Yeah, you know. So I'm Dr. Leslie Cannold. I've been mooching around the Byron Bay Writers Festival in my one of my latest incarnations, which is as a novelist. But for this session, I'm going to pick up some of my other hats, which is that I'm an ethicist. So I have a degree in ethics, and I worked for quite a long time with Peter Singer and then at the Center for Human Bioethics. After that, the Center for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics. One of my roles was to try to bring ethical discussions just like this one into the public domain. So hopefully I'll be able to do that for you. I'm also, and this is probably an important disclosure, I'm also a columnist for the Sun Herald in Sydney, which of course is a Fairfax paper. Yeah, so we're going to.
I'm amazed you're allowed in the tent.
And they let me in anyway, in the Weekend Australian tent, they let me in anyway, which just shows what an ecumenical kind of a meeting this is going to be. So I'm going to introduce our guests who are going to guide us through this process of getting us to the point where there's no eye rolling when we say the word ethics and media together. First, to my right, we have Philip Adams, who in some ways, of course, doesn't really need much of an introduction, but he deserves one, so I'm going to give him one. Philip is an atheist, an author, and an activist, and his first byline, and this is something I didn't know, his first byline appeared 60 years ago, which makes him one of the longest-serving journalists in Australia. I think that does deserve a hand. Now, Philip writes a column for The Australian and has done for many, many years. He has written dozens of books. His latest, and of course all the books we're going to discuss here, are on sale, and you can grab one and you can take it over to the signing tent and all these lovely men will be there ready to sign. So I hope you will take advantage of that, and I'm going to say that obnoxious announcement several times during this process. His latest book is Backstage Politics, which recounts encounters and conflicts with every prime minister since Menzies. He is the doyen of LNL, which is a little wireless program on Radio National. He's been there sitting in the chair for 20 years. He's done just about everything you'd want to talk about in terms of film. He's been a really important person in film in this country. He has many, many board memberships. He has 2 Orders of Australia, 4 honorary doctorates, and the undying detestation of John Howard and Jared Henderson. And for that, we congratulate him. To my left is Charlie Pickering. Charlie is a political junkie, a former lawyer, and the voice of his generation, which is Gen X, on Network 10's quiz show Talk and Voucher Generation. He can also be seen there each weeknight on Network 10 as a co-host of the 7pm Project, which, if you haven't seen it, is a really interesting kind of news magazine for the young folk. It mixes a bit of comedy and a fast pace.
I think some older people took offence to
that. And some of the older folk. Yeah. Some of the older folk, absolutely. I watch it. Charlie keeps his skills firing by doing a lot of stand-up, and I just found out by chatting to him the other night that he actually does stand-up at his local, so if anybody wants to know where Charlie lives, come see me afterwards. But you can also see him at very big venues like the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, the Adelaide Fringe Festival, the Brisbane Comedy Festival, blah, 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 all of those. You can find him there. He's earned a number of awards for his work in comedy, including the Perrier Best Newcomer Award in Edinburgh and the Barry Award for Most Outstanding Show at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Now, he's here, of course, as a writer. His first book is Impractical Jokes, and I heard him describe this book yesterday as a 10-year recounting of a practical joke war that went on between Charlie's father and father's best friend, Richard, which began with Charlie's father throwing Richard into the pool, fully clothed, I believe, and ended with Charlie's father and Charlie as a co-conspirator nearly blowing up a suburb. I have read the book, though, and I can tell you also it is a really touching memoir and ode, I think, of a son to his father. It's a really beautiful book, so I commend it to you. All the way to my left is Richard Glover. Richard is the author of 12 books, so he's no slouch. And his most recent is Why Men Are Necessary and More News from Nowhere, a collection of his comic pieces for radios, Thank God It's Friday. He has worked, and this is a very interesting set of jobs that Richard has had. He's worked variously as an actor, a newspaper journalist, a waiter, a Lyft driver, and a script writer. So I think we can feel we're in safe hands in terms of him swimming us to the other shore of this ethical dilemma that we're going to be talking about today.
The Lyft driving was a very up and down sort of job.
Yes. He's also a comedian. He's a columnist as well. He keeps very busy. He's a columnist as well at the Sydney Morning Herald. So again, they let him in. And that's a good thing. And he's also at 702 Sydney. So he's part of the national broadcaster. And he's... Well, I think pretty much we've said enough there. He's a very accomplished person. So we've done housekeeping. I think we're sort of ready to fire away. I'm going to pick that up. So I want to start by just recounting for you something that recently happened. Alan Jones was on his... Yes, I know. We're going to have to mention these names. Everybody's going to have to just rein it in. I'm going to have to talk about people who work in the media. Ready? Alan Jones, the other day, was on radio, and this is what he had to say. He said, human beings produce 0.001% of carbon dioxide in the air. Now, it turns out that's not true. Who could have guessed it? It turns out that... It isn't true, and so GetUp, which many people will know is an activist, a sort of web-based activist organization that's now actually one of the most powerful political lobbies in Australia, GetUp has made a complaint to ACME, which is the media regulator. Now, what Alan Jones said in response to the complaint that was made is he said the following. He said, "Much of my stuff is opinion. I am a broadcaster. I don't pretend to be a journalist. I don't know what that means anyway. Have they got a certificate or something?" So I wanted to ask Richard first, are you or have you ever been a card-carrying journalist?
Well, I don't think Alan didn't say that. Alan said, "I'm not a broadcaster, I'm an opinion maker, and human beings only produce 1.001% of carbon dioxide in the environment."
Was he doing an impression of John Michael Hollywood Housen at the time?
Yeah. No, he sounds... people who live in Sydney, you probably don't listen to him. He actually sounds like that. And I swear to God, I've heard him, because I listen to commercial radio, I have heard him say, do an ad for Saks Leather. "There's nothing like the feeling of leather against your body." Wow. "I'm Alan Jones." And wow. So, you know, Charlie thinks he's doing a comedy show. Alan has got it all over Charlie. It's perpetual. Look, the serious answer to that is I think people can go from mode to mode, and I think there's some things I do which are very journalistic and strive after some sort of level of objectivity. And I think, you can also state opinion. I write an opinion column, and I think you can even go from even within the course of a radio program, even in the course of 10 minutes, you can be in different modes. And most audiences are intelligent enough to understand that at this point you're interviewing someone and offering a contrary point of view to encourage debate, and at another mode you might be giving something that is like an opinion. I think the difference between what we try to do on the ABC and what Jones does is we don't privilege our opinions. Even if we state an opinion, it's not privileged as anything fancy, whilst he, of course, is really trying to convince people to be ditto heads and give them a point of view. To the extent that he corrals the information that the listener is given so as to encourage them to have his point of view.
But Charlie, is it important? I mean, is also one of the differences and maybe one of the confusions here is that when we're listening, we need to hear very clearly when someone in that role is speaking an opinion and when they're actually delivering journalism, whatever that is.
How do you make that a good broadcast, though? Do you ring a bell? Like, do you ring a little bell so everyone knows, oh, right now I'm a journalist, I'm not giving opinion? And then do you honk a horn when you're about to give an opinion? Like, it doesn't work like that. You actually have to rely on the people. Do you trust them? Do you not trust them? It's as simple as that. And the thing about Alan Jones, I mean, I think the problem with Alan Jones, he feels that he can just throw around lies as statistics because he's never really been punished for any time that he's broken an ethical code. But like you know, Casper comment was outrageous. Mm. That you can use the airwaves to just wring money out of the corporate world and like it was so transparent, found to be a corrupt individual in the way that he behaved, yet not taken off the air. And like at Channel 10, let's say I said the C-bomb 4 times in half an hour on TV, like I've been told that we lose our broadcast license at that just by swearing in a PG time slot.
Yeah.
Those sorts of penalties have to be taken seriously. You have to actually have the stick to beat someone with as a regulator. If you're going to enforce any level of ethics. And I think the problem with Alan Jones is he got into trouble. He was at that crisis in his career where it should have all have come crashing down and everyone should have learnt the lesson that you can't do that. You can't be paid $500,000 by a company just not to mention the opposition for a year. You know, something like that.
Yeah.
And worse, at some points it bordered on blackmail. You give me money or I will mention you.
Yeah.
But
it got to that point and no one... Yeah. No one took away all his toys. No one sent him to his room and locked the door.
So there was no consequence. But, Philip, if I can ask you, I mean, part of what was being said about Cash for Comment, and it might be also being said here, is that what people didn't understand was when Alan Jones or John Laws was speaking as someone who was actually giving a promotion, a paid promotion, and when they were doing the other things that they do. So, again, it seems to me the same thing about taking advantage of listeners not knowing when you switch from one role, which is journalist or broadcaster, and when you switch to paid advertiser or when you switch to opinion giver.
I actually worked with Jones and Laws, so I was up close and personal, so personal that when Alan came back from a certain embarrassment in London, he came round to see me. And I'd send him a very chirpy little email. I didn't do email then. I forget what I sent him, but I sent him something which was quite encouraging about British spunk. But you have to understand there are profound differences between a Jones and a Laws. Laws is consumed by self-hatred. Please don't repeat this outside the tent. But it's true. John is a highly, highly intelligent bloke. He's a dazzlingly clever broadcaster, but he does nothing but crap. And John knows he does nothing but crap, and he hates it. And he works with migraines. Almost every day of his career, Laws had a migraine, and he'd work through it. When the microphone was switched off at the end of the day, the famous golden microphone, although I always thought that he and Alan should have suppository microphones, you could basically fold John up like a ventriloquial doll, you know, and just put him in a case. He believes nothing. He believes nothing. And so Cash for Comment, that's grist to his mill. He makes no claims. And when he makes no claims, there's an authenticity about it. It's dinkum. Jones is one of the most desperately sad human beings I've ever known. And Jones is different in this one regard from almost everyone else in the shock jock business. All the others are bullshit. They don't mean what they say. You know, it's just grist of the mill. It's just the shtick. But Jones has to believe what he says, even if he's being paid to say it. Although Richard's right. The great crime of Jones wasn't the cash for comment. It was the cash for no comment, which was extortion. I wrote about it at the time, used those words, and didn't get into any trouble about it. So here's Jones, who's really on an agenda. And despite the appalling public shame of that inquiry, he fronts for almost every Liberal Party function. He's John Howard's, or was John Howard's, presenter of choice. So it's not just that he gets away with it on broadcast. He gets away with it in his public and social life. He's pathetic. He's just pathetic.
But it seems, I guess what's really interesting to me, though, is it seems like at the same time that you're all condemning what these men are doing and what happened here, so not just Cash for Comment, but this more recent kind of, you know, very stentorian delivery of a false fact about climate change, which is a very important issue at the moment, you still seem to be saying that ultimately it's let the buyer beware. But that basically all the punters out here need to be smart enough either not to listen to it at all, or when they do listen to it, to know without a bell ringing that they've switched from one mode, which is I need to be honest and fair dinkum here, to I'm advertising, to I'm giving you an opinion. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think to some extent his listener is to blame for still turning it on and for buying in and ringing up angry, but... And to that extent, they bring misinformation on themselves by not filtering more what he has to say. But still, there are rules of broadcast. There's if you write an article in the newspaper, you can be sued for defamation if you cross line, if you're unethical. Mm. Like you're meant to be able to get into trouble for poor behaviour.
Do you consider yourself a journalist, Charlie?
No, God no. no, but because I haven't had the training. I'm a comedian that got put in charge of a news show.
And do you blame the people who switch you on?
I mean, what could I possibly hold against those wonderful people? But I actually don't think anyone looks at me and thinks that I'm a journalist. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But the thing is, I try to apply my own standards to it. When I do commercial radio, I don't do live reads for products because I think it's confusing.
But
I think sound of me just editorialising about how good cornflakes are.
But the simple fact is that the greatest journalists on earth today are comedians. I think the most profoundly intelligent television program on public affairs is The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, by orders of magnitude, closely followed by the fake right-wing persona of Stephen Colbert. There's something about the comedic approach to news which is a breath of fresh air, although there's someone sitting in the audience today, Tim Bowden, who was a member of the original This Day Tonight team. Do you remember This Day Tonight? It was irreverent, it was cheeky, it was comic. It was decades ahead of its era. It was never self-important, but that didn't diminish the seriousness of its analysis or the seriousness of its commentary. So what you do is dead serious. It's just you do it funny.
Yeah, it's funny. Jon Stewart is a great example because when he goes on Fox News, on Bill O'Reilly's show, to explain to Bill O'Reilly why Fox News is a bad news organisation. And Bill O'Reilly says, yeah, but you guys did this. And he goes, but we're a comedy show on the Comedy Channel and I'm a comedian. The standards are meant to be different. The real irony is Jon Stewart's the only one that plays by the rule. Like, he plays by those ethical standards. And it's amazing how often the comedian's in that situation. And I think it's... I don't know if it's a... This might sound really strange. Part of why I try to be ethical in my TV job is show I can show my face at a comedy club to 30 people on a Monday night.
Really?
So I can walk on with some credibility because stand-up is my main thing and what I enjoy the most. But it's so I can walk in there and I can talk about whatever I want without anyone going, yeah, but...
You're dodgy.
And I can talk to my fellow comedians backstage and they can go, yeah, but you know the thing. You know, like, that's really important. And once you lose that, you can never get that back. And I think that's maybe one of the things that maybe comedians take themselves too seriously and think that stuff's important, but we do.
You're basically saying that it's a standard of a personal ethics and this whole idea. I guess what I'm worried about is I'm worried about this idea that when you get in trouble, so when Alan Jones has got in trouble, he's gone, oh, no, don't worry. It's not any problem here. I'm not really a journalist. I'm an entertainer or a radio broadcaster or a radio personality. Mm. And so, but it sounds like what you're saying is that at the core of all of this, you just have to be an ethical person. And if you're an ethical person, you'll do the right thing.
I do want to go back to that thing about the audience, because I think you're feeling that when we say blame the audience, that we're trying to take away responsibility from ourselves. And, you know, obviously you can't do that. But I think there is a point where you do. I mean, the News of the World, I think, is a very interesting case in that the British public have been kind of, you know, absolutely in a kind of an incredible state about what Murdoch has done to them, and yet they've bought the paper for five decades, you know, and they've got this kind of incredible sort of tone of surprise about it. Oh, really? You know, somebody said, you know, it's like a butcher holding up a leg of lamb and saying, "What? You're telling me they killed a sheep to get this?"
Look, I think this is very useful. The other day, Errol Simper, who writes a very good media column in the Oz, was writing about SBS's problems at the moment. And he dredged out an old quote of mine, which I'd forgotten, but which I think was pretty good. I apparently said, there was nothing wrong with SBS's programming. There was nothing wrong with its scheduling. The problem was with the audience. And I believe that. I think that the audience, the audiences, plural, present company accepted, are a bloody disgrace. They buy crap newspapers. With the present company accepted, they buy crap books. They eat crap food. They go look at crap television. They don't look at SBS. They don't, in sufficient numbers, listen to Radio National. You know, forget the debt ceiling, forget the glass ceiling, the ceiling of willful stupidity is enormous. And you're right, Richard, we have remote controls. We have pencils that we can vote with in little booths at elections. And we do the wrong things with our pencils. I mean, Bush was elected twice. And we do the wrong thing with our remote controls. We are, with the present company accepted, idiots.
There's something special about an audience who really wants to clap, that everyone clearly does feel that they're the exception.
We know we're not idiots.
We know, it's not us. Not us. So let's move on.
Sorry, I think we are idiots in this country too, because even though we haven't bought those... you know, the Murdoch papers are not like that in this country. You know, I know people criticise them, but they are not like the
They're
Sun.
Not like that.
They are really not like the Sun. You know, he's got page three... they've got naked women on page three of all these newspapers, which, again, the British blame Murdoch for. They say, oh, well, we were just sitting here and this terrible Australian came and as if he sort of had the whole nation by the ear and was forcing them to look at these breasts.
And they're forgetting Robert Maxwell, for example, who preceded him. I made the point the other day, I don't defend Rupert, I've known him for 40 years. He exaggerates existing tendencies. You know, if he detects a tendency in British life, he'll put his foot on the accelerator. If he detects a tendency in the United States, he didn't invent right-wing politics, the John Birch Society or McCarthyism, but he'll put his foot on the accelerator. Mm. But to blame him for our fucking failings is just a cop-out.
Well, I was actually going to talk about News of the World a little bit later, but since we've opened it up, let's talk about it now. One of the things that kind of interested me about this News of the World scandal is that there seems to be kind of a sharp contrast between one of the other big scandals that we're aware of. Of course, everyone's heard of Watergate. And it seems like in some ways, if we think back to what Watergate was about, it was really about the high watermark, perhaps, of journalism, where the journalists were the heroes. So the corruption was in the elected officials, and the journalists, Woodstein and Bernstein and Woodward, were the ones who actually got to the bottom of it. And they performed the role that in the fourth estate role that journalists are supposed to play in a democracy, where they're actually holding power to account. And now we skip forward a number of years, and all of a sudden what we have instead is the big scandal being the media itself, and yet the people who broke the story, the institution that broke the story, was the media. It was The Guardian, which stayed on the story for many, many years. So what does that tell us? Does it tell us that things are going backwards, or does it tell us that things are, you know, that the media is alive and well? It's just that the media is not a monolith. There's good media, as everyone seems to be saying, and then there's bad media. What do you think, Richard?
Well, I think there are two sides to the story of you know, I think there is a bit of a mongrel in any good journalist. There is a little bit of a mongrel, and if you want journalists to be entirely kind of like corporate figures, where they're, I'm not at all defending phone hacking, but there is a part of journalism which is based on the discussion at the pub and someone whispering you something and you taking it down and you following it up, and you know these are sort of mongrel acts, and they're not acts that are done by corporate people. And there are lots of examples in the media of, you know, you look at Dominic Strauss-Kahn or whatever he's called, and the fact that this guy was about to become president of France, and even if the situation, even if he didn't rape that poor housemaid in New York, it's been obvious, I think, in the last few weeks that this is a person with a very rapacious and nasty sexuality. And yet obviously the French media, for their part, he was a man who was about to become president, and yet for the French media for the last 10 years it's been, oh, well, that's monsieur. Of course, monsieur has a personal life. We won't talk about that. Mm. So, you know, and I happened to see a magazine from the Middle East the other day, just before Amy Winehouse died. And there was a big, she was about to tour there, and there was a big article about Amy Winehouse, which didn't mention the fact that she had any drug issues at all. It was just, oh, there's a pop star coming to our country. How lovely. So, you know, there is a way in which you can have a media which is too tidy and discreet and nice and well-behaved. And that's a problem for democracy, as much as a media which has gone so far the other way that they're hacking the phones of murder victims.
Yeah, so that's a great point. So where do you draw the line, and how do you draw the line, Charlie?
You don't draw the line. It shifts in the sand all the time. Mm. You know, I don't have a guidebook for life. I don't have a Bible that I use as my moral compass. And so I find my own life in personal ethics as much as in anything. They shift. You know, to imagine there's a sort of a Ten Commandments for journalism is bullshit. There isn't. And what we see as heroic and courageous one day becomes venal and unpleasant the next. What you want is tenacity, you want curiosity, you want courage. But even Watergate, which everyone always talks about with genuflection, there's another theory about Watergate. And I remember a wonderful piece by another a member of the newspaper, the Washington Post, not one of Ben Bradley's associates, who said, "We were led by the nose. We did not investigate. We were given a paper trail quite deliberately to take us from that point to this point to bring down Nixon." And that argument was that Nixon wanted, the enemies of Nixon weren't the Democrats. They were people in the Republican Party who thought Richard Nixon was too left-wing. So, okay, Woodward and Bernstein, fantastic. But there's always complexities. There's always paradox. It's never that simple.
There was also the other element of, to my understanding, of Watergate that often gets forgotten is Wood and Bernstein ran their pieces in the Washington Post, and the world didn't crumble. Like, the presidency didn't fall apart at that moment. They were out there in the papers, and some people read it and were angry about it. Some people ignored it. Not everyone was reading the Washington Post. It didn't make a big deal. And one night, Walter Cronkite went on air on TV, which reaches more people than the Washington Post, and he joined the dots for everyone. He spent ages on TV going, and then this says this, and this happened here, and this is what is going on in the White House right now. And had it not been for a Walter Cronkite, it might not have brought down the president.
Well,
it might not have regulated.
Cronkite has another great string to his bow. The horrors of Vietnam had been going on for ages. There'd been protest movements. But it was Cronkite who brought a blackboard onto the set. Mm. He was the god of news in America, and he taught America with a blackboard and chalk what was really happening in Vietnam. So his personal credibility and personal morality overwhelming the ordinary rules and issues, and you need a couple of Walter Cronkites badly.
But because is that what you're basically arguing? So basically what we're missing is the personalities, because it really does seem that when you talk about Cronkite in that way, and that's a really interesting story that I didn't know, again, we're talking about journalists as heroes. We're talking about journalists really on a very high level performing this arguably essential function where you have to have power checked. We have to have a way as citizens to know what the government is doing that's separate from what the government wants us to know. And at the core of it, that's what political journalism is. So what happened between then and now, where I mentioned journalism and ethics and the entire room groans? What happened between these times?
As Philip said, there aren't the Ten Commandments of journalism. These are the rules that you follow to be ethical and have credibility as a journalist. What Walter Cronkite did over a number of years is he just set his own rules and said, this is how a fearless but ethical journalist will behave.
Ed Murrow did it before him too.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you do that long enough, what you build up is that credibility and respect with your audience, whether it's a reading audience or a viewing audience. And that's where you're actually in the position to shape those ethics and have an impact. But the only way you get to that, to have that level of credibility and trust, that level of trust, is by playing by your own rules year after year after year and not thinking, fuck it, I want a raise, so I'm going to hack someone's phone. Or, you know, not thinking, do you know what, I want to break the big story on the front page.
Well, this raises the other issue. Everyone is conscious of censorship as an issue. The greatest danger in journalism is self-censorship, and it is all pervasive. I was at the ABC during its darkest days when Jonathan Shire and, you know, these other loonies were on the Howard Stacked board, were doing their best to crush the life out of it. And the sense of fear through that organisation was palpable, and I saw people. I'm on short-term contract, and I'm too old. I don't give a stuff. I've got nothing to lose. But I'm surrounded by young people at the ABC who've got mortgages, who've got a couple of kids at school, and who lived in dread of being shown the door. So even at the ABC, you sensed self-censorship. Now that's another. That's not covered on ethics. You don't find that on the list of ethical considerations. But fear by a journalist can be just as terrible as duplicity.
So somehow, I guess, then the argument would be that between...
I mean, it must be like that at Fairfax at the moment. I mean, it's terrifying to work in a newspaper now.
I'm agnostic. But it's essentially then what we're saying is that from the 70s till now, what has changed is the environment in which journalists can feel are able to stay on air long enough and be comfortable enough to gain trust, or in which journalists don't feel fearful and therefore actually can act with integrity. It just seems to me like we still got human beings, and human beings are exactly the same, and yet we no longer seem to have these heroes. And I really would like understand why.
But you also have corporate cowardice. Go back, you mentioned Woodward. Woodward became an apologist for Bush. He churned out book after book after book supporting Bush on Iraq. It was only the last book when he belatedly changed his mind. But look at the total failure of American media to really take it up to Bush and the war in Iraq. It wasn't just individual journalists being afraid. It was the entire corporate American media. It almost made what John Pilger said yesterday sound reasonable. You know, John doesn't take prisoners. John, it's right or wrong, it's black or white, it's, you know. Mm. But it was like that in America. It was like, and it wasn't much better here.
I remember I was on air on Triple J the day the first bombs fell in the Iraq war. And we mentioned it a little bit in the build-up, but Australian support of that, like Howard's support of that war, was so clear.
He was on the blower day. To Bush pushing it. That's something that Woodward revealed.
And I remember on air, we were, like, we wanted, the day that it happened, we thought, we are the youth broadcaster. We should be talking about the fact that you shouldn't just, this should not be happening. The rationale for war has not been established. We should not be supporting this. And the ABC were saying, you can't, that's because that's partisan political. That was seen as, oh, you are being anti the government of the day, therefore you're picking a political side. So you can't. So all we did is we didn't do a show that day. We just played songs, and
really?
In between songs we went to air and said, just so you know, the war has just started in Iraq. We don't feel it's a day that we can make jokes. We'll see you again tomorrow. And that's all we did for the whole day.
Yeah.
But that was as loud a protest as we were allowed to muster within the ABC, because we all knew, and we were told by management, by Triple J management at the time, you can't go on air and say what you want to say, because that'll be a breach of the guidelines that says you're not allowed to be one side or the other on the ABC.
I must say, I think the ABC's got some of its mojo back lately, but it is important that you know, much and all, as we all love the ABC, that it has been cowardly and it has not done its job during some very, very dark periods. It's not just Rupert, it's even the ABC.
Wow. That's depressing but important to know. I wanted to ask you, given we are talking about personal ethics and personal standards, I wanted to ask you, Richard, I'll start with, mm-hmm. but I want to ask all of you, about a personal ethical dilemma that you faced in your work as a... We never really got to the bottom of whether you all call yourself journalists, as journalists, broadcasters, whatever you call yourselves.
I suppose the one that I still think about most was the day after the Cronulla riot. And running a talkback show in Sydney was quite a difficult thing, and I still don't quite know how you would get that right. But we didn't cause the riot. Alan did. So you know, he actually, you know, virtually sold tickets to it, you know, for several days running up to it, and encouraged people to go down there and make trouble. But then the day after, you know, there'd been this sort of terrible event, and it was building up to another terrible event because there was this kind of revenge thing happening on the part of the Middle Eastern community who were all going to go back that next night. And there were a lot of people ringing up with very strong opinions about it. And some of them, you know, some of them were people really just wanting to rant about Middle Eastern people, and I think it's pretty clear that you don't put those people to air. But there was also a category of people, for instance, young women wanting to ring up and say, well, look, I understand the heat of this thing because I live at Cronulla or I live at Bondi Beach, and I don't feel, as an 18-year-old Anglo girl, that I can go down to my beach anymore because the Lebanese men, they said, catcall me and whistle at me and sexually harass me. And they wanted to say that. And do you put that call to air? And there were lots of them. And I don't quite know the answer to that.
What did you do?
We put some of them to air. And I think in the course of the conversations, I would sometimes say, you know, are you sure those men treating you badly are actually Lebanese? Well, you say you're very confident that they're Lebanese. You know, do you know they're Lebanese, or has Lebanese just become shorthand for any man who is awful to you? So I think, you know, I mean, part of the utility of taking the call is that you can then engage the caller in some sort of discussion about the point. In terms of not putting that to air, I think you had to put some of it to air, because there was this huge debate in the community about what had happened and why it had happened, and to entirely suppress one of the causes of it seemed to be really not allowing the good side of talkback radio, which is a town square in which everyone can meet and everyone can talk.
It must be difficult, though, in that situation where, as you say...
It's all lies.
You are very confident, in your opinion, that Alan Jones was, by and large, responsible for that mm-hmm. being the situation that it was. And there must often be a temptation in your mind to go, I have the power to redress some of the balance. I've got just as many listeners, and I can... And he doesn't put the open-minded people to air. He only puts the hate to air. He does that edit. He doesn't play by those rules.
Well, and he would have put those calls to air, the women complaining.
Oh, he put the women, but he wouldn't put anyone to air going, well, I think any Anglo that goes down there to be someone...
He doesn't put anyone to air who is subtle or who calibrates or contextualises. I've worked in this system. It's completely and utterly shonky. Mm. There are tame ringer-inners, and there are occasionally poor... sacrificial objects that are allowed on. It is so manipulated. It is not open line.
Mm. Mm-hmm. But it must be tempting in your situation to go, do you know what? If I put 10 callers in a row to air condemning this, then this could redress the balance.
That's a very popular view among ABC listeners, I must say, that we are there to redress somebody else's ills, and people say, why you have concern? You know, we have Peter Jensen, for instance, on our political forum quite often, and that makes people very upset, actually. They say, we don't want to hear... we have Pell on sometimes. That makes people very upset. But, you know, I don't see our role as to... as to make up for the ills of other people. I see our role as to provide a good, healthy marketplace of ideas in which you can hear young people. And the great glory of ABC Local Radio, unlike Jones, is that you actually have a lot of young people listening and a lot of older people and a lot of Liberal voters and a lot of Labor voters, and here is a space where you can meet and have a civilised discussion. So I don't see my role as to barricade the entrance points to that marketplace of ideas and say, you can't come in.
Now, Charlie, I want to follow up a little bit on some of the ideas that Richard was talking about. You also had a very interesting ethical dilemma recently in the 7pm project, but you're probably going to have to background people a little bit.
Sure.
It was about the St Kilda schoolgirl. But I want you, if you can, just to pick up a little bit on Richard's discussion, because it sounds like what he was talking about was needing to rely on his own internal ethical code about making that decision about who to put to air. And I'd be interested to know how you resolved this issue with the St Kilda schoolgirl.
It was definitely the hardest moment, the hardest day I've had on 7pm. And it all made me take my job at 7pm a lot more seriously. What happened, the St Kilda schoolgirl story, for those that don't know, there's a young girl, she's been involved with various AFL footballers. She's linked to AFL player manager Ricky Nixon, who was meant to be a mentor looking after her. She released photos and videos suggesting that he had given her drugs and alcohol in a hotel room. She had told that story to the media, and that was out there. And then
This was all after she'd been in and out of the media for a very long time.
Yeah.
Arguably showing that she was quite young and disturbed.
But there was also a prevalent opinion amongst people that she was very calculating and manipulative, and she was controlling that media. She could start a media cycle whenever she wanted one. She was very good with social media, and she was able to do that. That was the prevailing opinion. So there was one day that she came out and she said that she'd made it all up, and it was on the day that they were doing the ethics investigation, like the whether or not Ricky Nixon was going to lose his license to practice as a player manager, and she came out and said, look, I made the whole thing up. And the whole thing smelt of a payoff. Right, there's a conspiracy, let's get to the bottom of it. And we were a bit swept up in the fact that this is a salacious story. Everyone's in, you know, it's professional sport, schoolgirl sex, drugs, it's money, it's an exciting story. And people,
so you got her on 7pm?
We got her on 7pm, and we pre-recorded the interview. She came in, we started the interview at about 6:20, and we finished recording the interview at 6:45, and it then had to go and be edited. So we had 15 minutes before we went to air. About 30 seconds into the interview, I was uncomfortable being there. The moment she answered the first question, every thought, everything I'd read that she was calculating, she was 17 going on 47, like all of that completely disappeared, and I just knew this is a child, and we're asking questions of a child about things you should never ask a child about. And as the interview went on, I got less and less comfortable, and it kept going on and on. But don't get me wrong, I knew in the back of my head the whole time, this shouldn't be happening, but fuck me, it's good television, right? Like, I knew in my mind, like, there's also that TV producer voice in my head saying, no one is switching the channel during this interview. But we got to the end of the interview, and we wrapped it up. We thanked her for coming on. And just before she got up and left, she said, while the cameras were on, but after we'd said, thanks very much for your time. So after the interview had finished officially, she said, oh, that was so hard. I mean, you know. I mean, I'm making this whole thing up. And we had that on camera.
I'm sorry, say that again.
She actually said on camera, but after we said thank you very much, she said, I'm making the whole thing up. It's all bullshit.
So making up the retraction.
She was making up the retraction.
She thought the interview was over, and then she said, I just lied to you.
Everything I just said in this interview now, clarifying, changing my story, it's all bullshit, I'm making it up. And really implied, like very strongly implied, I'm being made to do this by Ricky Nixon. Like that was the feeling, like that was implied by the way that she said it. And then we stopped and she left, and Craig Campbell, the executive producer, came in and said, we want to play that last bit where she said everything is a lie. And I said, I don't want to play any of it. We're at this point 14 minutes from going to air. It has to be edited. Everyone else on the panel was, no, it's fine, we were nice, we were caring, we were, you know, like, we looked after her feelings, we gave her a fair shot, she said this thing and that thing, all we did was listen. And I was saying, no, this is a child. is a child who, more than anything else, has been chasing love that she has never had, and it has taken her to terrible places. And we should not be part of that. We should not dangle that carrot of affection or being welcoming and then just use her for more viewers. And so we had a big argument. I walked out of the studio. Craig and I had an argument. Frank, an honest sharing of ideas. And we reached a compromise because...
What was the compromise?
Well, the compromise was that the interview would go to air and we would then air the retraction, because we actually felt, to our audience, if we're going to show the interview, we have to show the part where she says, all of that's a lie. Otherwise, we just become part of the lie. But I said, I have to be allowed to say that I'm not comfortable with this. I have to be able to say on air that we argued about this and I don't want this going to air. And I was allowed to do that. The shame about that was that that became the story. I had my phone ringing the next morning. Why did you object? What's the fight at Channel 10? Are you going to leave the show? You know. But for me, I had to, for myself, and for whatever reason, for anyone that watches that show because they trust me, if there's anyone out there that does that, I felt that I had to say, I had to be able to show that, do you know what? I don't own the cameras. I don't own the station. I'm not the executive producer. So I don't have the power to make the decision that this does not go to air. To be honest, I should have been stronger earlier in the day and said, I'm not doing the interview. And I realised that while I was doing it. But I was in. I was too far in. I had to be able to state, I object to this so that it's out there. But I think the big mistake that we made is we became part of the story. And one of the strengths of our show, it should always be, let's talk about the story. Let's look in from the outside and form an opinion on it. Because I think once you become part of the story, and this is an interesting thing about the Cronulla riots, once you are an element in the story, once you are part of creating the news or keeping it going, I think you lose the right to be commenting on it. I think you lose the right to have an opinion. If you've become an agent, if you've become a catalyst in it, then your opinion is tainted.
Well, you know, 2GB in Sydney, for people who don't know this, have actually organised the buses for one of those climate change rallies in Canberra. They actually organised the buses.
Okay, I'm opposed to capital punishment, but would make an exception in the case of Alan Jones. But as you were talking, I suddenly remembered a repressed memory. I don't believe in a repressed memory, but I've obviously got one. And this shows you the ethical complexities of working in commercial media. Bob Hawke and I don't talk. We had a fist fight in an airport lounge, but I've always been very fond of Hazel. And when I was at 2UE, so this is 24, 25 years ago, Hawke's Prime Minister, Hazel's First Lady, I rang her up and said, look, I'd like to have the night off. Can you come in and do a pre-record so, you know, I can go home early? And she did, and we decided she just wanted to talk about her life pretty much in sequence. So Hazel's sitting there, and she's starting to talk about when she was a church organist, I think, and how she met Bob, and da-dum-da-dum-da-dum. And it was all quite sweet. And then she suddenly said, and then I lost the baby. And to my astonishment and horror, she burst into tears when she remembered losing a child all those many, many years ago. I immediately stopped the recording. I didn't want her pain on going out on air. I said, Hazel, don't worry, we'll erase it. Let's have a cup of tea and we'll pick it up. So I gave her my undertaking that it would never go to air. Next morning, the front page on the Daily Mirror, or the Telegraph, was Hazel weeps over dead baby. Because 2UE sent a dub of the broadcast I thought had been erased to the newspaper. Now, you can imagine how Hazel felt towards me. You know, she thought that I didn't be involved in an act of betrayal. I never forgave them that. It was one of the reasons I jumped ship and went to the Elephant's Graveyard of Radio National. But it makes the point, and the dynamics of your story reminds you of this. Once upon a time, someone... I was taken by this. Someone explained the art of riding the bicycle thus. I said, riding a bike is a constant process of falling off. In other words, you're constantly adjusting balance. That's what ethics are. To me, it's an ethical decision whether or not to get up in the morning. You know, it's an ethical decision to decide whether you will pick up that hitchhiker. It's an ethical decision. There's thousands of them. You make them every minute. Every question one asks as a journalist is an ethical decision, the way the question is framed. And you can only get some of it right. You were put in an impossible position, and I think you did pretty well. I thought I handled an ethical situation well, but was betrayed by a completely unscrupulous media organisation. I mean, it ain't easy out there. It ain't easy getting it right. You're often not even sure what is right yourself.
Yes,
you're often not sure what is ethical.
But you get that smell. It smells. It's like you're in a situation, you go, this smells wrong.
Yeah, and big capital E ethical situations, I agree. But there's lots of things which aren't big capital E neon lit. They're just smaller issues.
And you also, practically and from a career point of view, there are people, and you come across them, who fight every possible ethical decision every day, down to the wording of a sentence, down to, you know, like, and some, like, don't get me wrong, sentences need to be grammatically correct and they should sound good when they go to air. But they, like, you shouldn't argue over every sentence every day all the time. And those people become so difficult to work with that they stop being part of what
and you... You need to have important debates and recognise this is a moment where we have to stop and have a debate. So if you're debating absolutely everything, you lose the forest for the trees. Absolutely.
And it's very difficult to evolve that judgment about how do I stop being... difficult and actually play a role in ethical decisions.
But can I just pick something up about that? Because one of the things about your book, and we've inadequately mentioned books here, so remember everybody's written one. Charlie's book, though, I think when you talk about this idea that it smells, to me what I think about is I think, well, you have something in you where there's, and all of you do, I think, profoundly have this inner idea about right and wrong. And of course we all have to grow up, we have to develop these ideas of right or wrong, or else we're really roving around like a psychopath. So all of us have inner ideas about what's right and wrong. So do you think, because to me your book spoke about getting some of that inner idea and that feeling about what smells and what doesn't from your dad?
Yeah, definitely. Family in general, it definitely comes from that. My dad just taught me to do the right... He always just did the right thing. Like, he fixed everything in the house, right? Not particularly well. There's a toilet that still doesn't work properly 20 years on. But he was relatively successful in his business. He could have been paying someone to come and fix stuff all the time. But it was like in his mind, he was like, it's just... That's not right. You know, like, I can do it. I should be doing this. And he was always about the long run. Always just about... You have to do the right thing all the time. It'll pay off eventually. Don't take the shortcut. And it annoyed the shit out of me because when you're young, shortcuts are great. You get it done more quickly. You got more time on your hands, and a lot of time they're fun, you know. But it turns out, and it took me becoming an adult somewhere along the line to realise that it's true. Like, it is actually just true. But it all depends on your priorities. Like, you know, what you decide is important. Everyone decides it for themselves. The fact of the matter is... you know, you have a look at the debate over what is the role of government in this country, and a lot of people think the role of government is just never to tax anyone ever. You know, like, that is the government's job. Whereas there's another side of politics that says the role of government is to understand that the strong, the wealthy and the powerful, they're okay. They don't need more of your help. But those that aren't strong, wealthy and powerful, that's who a government should work for. Mm.
Well, that's
but the other side of politics would say, no, they need to get off their ass. Mm. What about us? I run a fucking sandwich shop and no one's helping me. But you know what? Who's to say who's right and wrong? That's the nature of two sides of a debate.
Well, that's a good seg, because we're going to ask a last question, and then I'm going to make sure that there's time for all of you to ask questions. So I think the last question, and we'll probably have to do it a bit quickly, is, you know, where... If you had to make one change, and surely, you know, we've talked a lot about personal ethics, but if there was one thing that you could think about to be different about the current media landscape, do we need privacy laws? Do we need a change in terms of the deconcentration of ownership. Last night I was speaking to a former news journalist who reckoned that what we needed was a government-appointed ombudsman to hold journalists account to something. Yeah, well, exactly. So what
happens
you
when you have a dictatorship and that person can hang journalists right. that they don't like
yeah,
what they
exactly.
say?
Exactly. But what would you say was the one thing, and I'll just go
okay,
through the
really,
three
really,
of you.
This might seem trivial, but for everyone to buy iPads and get apps so they pay for quality journalism. Because that is the real problem facing the media, is that broadsheet newspapers like The Australian and The Herald and The Age and papers like The Fin Review are really what generate stories for Charlie and for me and even for Philip. That is the sort of engine room of democracy. And the Sydney Morning Herald income, for instance, is now 10% of what it was 10 years ago. And it cannot afford the journalism that really a democracy like ours requires. So get an iPad and pay for journalism.
Okay, pay for journalism. Charlie, what do you think?
That's really hard. I think some level of privacy laws would be good. I think maybe you need laws in place to tell a newspaper where they have to stop, or you know, an investigative journalist where to stop. Maybe that's useful. But
well, arguably, the News of the World story was really all about the privacy of citizens being invaded. So is there something for us to learn there?
I think there definitely is, and I think it's something that you don't take seriously until it's given a grotesque face of a young dead girl's voicemail was hacked, and then everyone goes, "Oh, hang on, we've crossed the line. Well, the line was crossed a long time ago." But I would like to see, getting onto the, let's deal with the future. Everyone should have an app, you know, like, and pay for their content on their iPad to give an income stream to good journalism. At the same time, the online world has to play by the same rules as the print world. It seems that proofreading's less important. Spelling and grammar is less important. Facts tend to be less important. And I think those rules have to apply everywhere. Well, you can't say, this is the internet, it's the Wild West, you can do whatever you want. It's not. It's where all the action is now. That's where everyone's going for their information. So the same rules have to apply. You have to be able to be sued for defamation and the law has to catch up with that electronic environment.
Okay, so we need to change the law. And Philip, what do you think?
I'll put it back on the audience and on the readers and say that, sum it up by saying, read more, think harder.
That's a fantastic.